Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist on health, food, and the environment, public policies concerning them, and the media. I've been reporting on these issues for a couple of decades on a variety of sites, including the Huffington Post, Alternet, EcoWatch, and my own website, healthjournalistblog.com. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and our total environment, including our communities, our society, and the health and fate of the earth. Every week on Connect the Dots, we talk to different experts, authors, thought leaders, advocates, healers, about different facets of all of the things that contribute to our well-being beyond our personal health choices. We look at our social choices, our society's choices, and how we can participate and take action to trend things in a way that supports health and a healthy environment. That's what we do every week on the show. This week, I am really thrilled to have returning a guest that we've had before, who's been one of the people who has had a profound influence on my own thinking. He's here with a book, his next book, or his current book. We've had him on for some of his previous books. He's a very prolific author. Our guest today is Robert W. McChesney. He's professor of communications at the Center for Global Studies at the University of Illinois. And he's also the author, very impressively, of many, many different books. He co-founded Free Press, a national media reform organization. If you've been hearing about net neutrality, we've supported it and had shows on it, and actually very timely decisions about it now. In terms of preserving free access and open access equitably and for all on the Internet, that we know about it thanks to Free Press, which is a media progressive media organization. McChesney has written or edited 27 books, and we're here today to discuss his most recent book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Previously, he was on the show discussing digital disconnect, how capitalism is turning the Internet away from democracy. We just had a month of programming on techno-utopia, the hope and fantasy that, that technological solutions, including the Internet, were going to be our saving grace. Bob's previous book, also written as Dollarocracy is, with John Nichols, was The Death and Life of American Journalism, the media revolution that will begin the world again. And he's not talking about the promise of the Internet, which, as we've seen since that prescient early work, is also subject to influence and money pressures and economics, and not to mention privacy issues. So this is a very rich terrain. It's one, I think, that's really important, because so as goes the media, so goes our society, our cultural attitudes, beliefs, and actions. And that's why it's my delight and honor to welcome you, Bob McChesney, to Connect the Dots yet again.
It's my pleasure to be here.
In your book, Dollarocracy, and I just want to flag for people that it is now available in a paperback edition so that people can get it. It's terrific reading. It was originally published in 2013. We're now on the cusp of 2015. If anything, in rereading the book at this time, it was, like all your work, prescient. So let's dive right into it, because I think some of the ideas will be extremely familiar to people, and I just want to flag before we begin our conversation that you and John Nichols in this book, which has a foreword by Senator Bernie Sanders, were the first to kind of make some of these points and really draw attention to this. So first of all, what is Dollarocracy?
Well, it's as the name implies. Dollarocracy, as opposed to democracy, is a situation where power is exercised $1, one vote, whereas in a democracy, it's exercised as one person, one vote. So those with lots of dollars have all the power. Those with no dollars have no power. And those with, whereas in a democracy, theoretically, Everyone is an equal, has an equal amount of political power over the course of the society. And our argument in the book, Allison, is that what's taking place with our election system, with the flood of money and the collapse of journalism, is that it is making dollarocracy that much more pronounced and that much more difficult for the citizenry to use the political system, the election system, to exercise any remote chance of reforming the system in a more humane or democratic manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that, you know, the recent election in which a lot of voters stayed home, resulting in a very poor outcome for the Congress and Senate, you know, really illustrates that point. You know, what are your comments about that? This is exactly what the book was warning against and predicting, and it happened. Why does it happen?
Well, the low voter turnout has been a recurring problem in the United States compared to other democracies for a long time, really throughout our history. To some extent, it is due to explicit measures to keep blacks, people of color, from voting. That's our historical legacy. And then what has happened in the last century, especially in the last 50 years, is that people in power, the owners of the country, to be blunt, the Chamber of Commerce, the Business Roundtable, the Fortune 500 CEOs, you know, I think at a certain point in the 1970s, they came to an appreciation that having a low voter turnout is not a bad thing for their interests. The lower the voter turnout, the more likely it is that the business will dominate politics. And this was made explicit in a few pieces written in the 70s. But I think if you understand that, everything that follows makes a lot of sense. I mean, despite MTV's rhetoric about how much they want everyone to vote, we live in a society that makes it very difficult to vote, discourages voting, and now we're finding in what can only be called an obscene direction for our country, in half the states of the country, those with Republican control over the government, we're seeing explicit measures to basically limit the right of poor people, people of color, young people to vote.
Comparing where we are today with, you know, where things were in terms of cultural attitudes and understanding of this phenomenon at the time that you were writing the book and when the hardback came out just, a year or a little over a year ago, do you see a shift in public understanding about this? I mean, it seems like if you didn't get it then, you surely must understand it now. But then again, if we had understood it, why, you know, would we have had these unfortunate outcomes? What's your view on that?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think the in one sense, the research John and I did in the book, which goes in great detail about who's giving the money, how much is being spent, what effect it has on one hand. And the other side of the coin is that we have most of this money being spent on these dreadful political ads, mostly negative political ads, that are, no matter which candidate does them, are almost all inane, but they've become the lingua franca of our political culture. And there's so little journalism that they've replaced whatever existed of journalism to cover politics. And it's really created this sort of sewage political system. It's really a sewer. And, you know, what Americans, I think Americans are sort of inured to this because they've never really tasted anything differently. This is just more of what we've had for the last several decades. And one of the things that's striking to me, I had a chance to go to other countries quite a bit, and it's stunning to see an election campaign for national government in a democracy, not a dollarocracy, because in most countries of the world, political advertising for candidates is illegal. It's not permitted. It's considered sort of like toxic propaganda. Campaigns are much shorter. There's hardly any money involved. There's actually still some news media coverage of candidates, and candidates get free airtime from all the parties in the system, not just the two dominant parties, to have access to the airwaves to talk to the people of their country. So I think Americans, if they ever taste that and see what an actual Democratic campaign looks like, where it seems like there's some meaning to the race and there's some real issues you can sink your teeth into, then they would come back to America and be appalled at what we have. But since most Americans, understandably, only experienced the U.S. system, they think this is what democracy is. They think this is what an election is. It's basically billionaires paying anonymously for a slew of atrocious TV ads, and that's what politics is all about, without any news media covering it to speak of.
Well, you know, what coverage there is like, for example, I'm thinking of, you know, the so-called liberal media like MSNBC, you know, so they're sort of chiming in on some of these fronts. But at the same time, I mean, they're kind of focused a great deal on the kind of combat Spartacus zone of the electoral and political process because that brings viewers. Is that helpful? Where can people turn, you know, for coverage that would really be helpful and enlightening for this and how to deal with it?
Well, they can't turn anywhere. That's the problem, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't mean you don't consume news media. That doesn't mean as a citizen you're darndest to find information. There are some great journalists in this country. Most of them aren't getting paid very much, if they're getting paid at all. But the problem is that the obsession of our news media's coverage of politics and political campaigns is with spin, it's with trivia, it's with gossip. MSNBC, which, you know, I watch periodically, you know, I think it was the day after the 2014 election, they started gossiping about who would be the nominee in 2016 for president. And, you know, mm-hmm. so that it's nutritionless content. It's
nutritionless
about polls.
Content.
Yeah, it's polls and spin. I mean, frankly, the sort of coverage we get across our news media of political campaigns, it's probably compatible with debates you would have in an authoritarian society about elections to the central committee of a one-party state. I mean, it's really the sort of stuff really touches on actual issues of power. For example, you know, in the last election, the 2014 election, or the presidential election in 2012, you know, the real issues that the government's facing on, you know, how much spying is there going to be, how much militarism is our society going to have, tax rates, jobs, barely talked about, you know. So we have issues like how safe is Social Security? We get sort of homilies, we get sort of banal statements at most, but they really have nothing to do with what people in power are actually going to do once they're there. And, you know, so we don't have a politics that really has much meaning to people as the voters in terms of this is going to make a difference if I vote. And viewed that way, And I want to emphasize, I vote, and I think everyone should vote. But I think viewed that way, it's not astounding that only 35% of American adults voted in our national elections 2 weeks ago. Rather, it's astounding that many did. Because if you look at what most voters face, Allison, when they go into the poll, most of the seats they're going to vote for legislative, either the U.S. House or their state legislature, are gerrymandered. So they really are not competitive. They're like voting in the Bulgarian Politburo election of, you know, 1953. You basically know before you go in the poll exactly who's going to win the race because there's no competition. And the only races where you theoretically get competition are the statewide races or citywide races that can't be gerrymandered. But then big money comes in a tidal wave, basically, and dominates. Moreover, you're stuck with two parties. And sometimes the parties don't want to compete with each other. Sometimes there's not that much difference. But there's not an effective alternative outside of that. Everything in the system right now is pointed towards getting people out of active involvement in electoral politics. I mean, if that is the implicit goal of the system. They don't say the opposite, but it's preposterous. If you couldn't devise a system that's better suited towards making a rational human say, I want no part of the system, it's a joke.
Yes, a lot of younger people say that. I get into those conversations, you know, in person with people as well as on Facebook threads and all of that. That's a very common thing. And yet, and I voted too, and, you know, to me it's like a public responsibility to vote, and it's actually painful sometimes given the choices, and I personally dread the upcoming presidential election in terms of the options for liberal progressive voters in that election. But it is essential all the same, and that's the strange thing. Right now, as we speak, for example, there was a referendum proposition on the ballot in the state of Oregon on whether GMO foods should be labeled. And of course, you know, what used to be a local vote, oh, this state is deciding to label them, really is an issue of national concern, because for those who would like to see a GMO labeled, GMOs labeled, to know what's in their food and be able to make that choice for their family, you know, if it happens in a handful of states, then it becomes nationwide in effect. It's not that every single state has to ratify this, because it just becomes a practical question of how you print the label. Right now, as we speak, several weeks after the election, that vote is still undetermined. Food industry spent over $10 million in political ads, and that, you know, on that election to dissuade people and to encourage them to vote no on the referendum. Right now, there's something like 4,500 votes among millions of people who voted that separate the two sides. And in addition, there are 13,000 ballots that are, you know, the state has declared questionable or problematic in some way. And so the people who are on the yes side have been on the ground trying to track down anyone who's been, you know, telling people to reach out to their friends to search an online tech fix where you can find out if your ballot is one of the ones that are in the, that are in this 13,000 that they're just going to throw out because they have something that's been defined as a technical problem. So here you have the degree of pushback of where really, literally, either way you want to call it, half the state, despite $10 million, voted yes on the referendum, and yet it comes down to this hair wire thin difference between, you know, the numbers on both sides, with, you know, basically three or four times that amount just kind of thrown out by election officials, you know, for reasons that may or may not be bona fide. So I'm bringing this case up because I think it really illustrates the criticalness of every single vote at the same time, in the face of this money force. At the same time, the yes side may lose because of these technicalities, and that would lead to further kind of disgruntlement in a sense that we can't make a difference. Love to hear your comments on that.
Well, you touched on two really important points. The first one is that there are elections that are important, and big money floods the system when they've got something at stake, overwhelming the opposition to try to prevent popular democracy from actually taking place. And in the book, we chronicle example after example of those on everywhere, and the people can win. And I think the other point you're getting at, which really underscores the book and I think understanding American politics today, is that the United States is not a right-wing country. The United States is not a country that wants to turn the vast majority of people are interested in having corporations not pay taxes, having, you know, unemployment be high so you can keep profits high. That's not the will of the people of this country. And I think one of the things that was striking as we did the research on dollarocracy was to see that, you know, the effort to limit the vote, to shrink it down, was based on the idea that the business community has understood since the 1960s and 70s that the majority of the American people are not malleable to their program. They can't sell it if there's actually 60, 70, 80% voter turnout. We'd have a very different country, assuming there were political parties that represented the interests of the majority of the people in this country. So one of the ironies of the last election, and fortunately you're hearing a little less of this, but it used to be, you know, certainly in 2010 and previous years, pundits would go, well, it looks like the American people have changed their mind. They can't make up their mind. 2008, they want Democrats. 2010, they're voting in Republicans, then Democrats and Republicans. What sort of crazy group of people are these American voters? In fact, what has happened between 2008 and 2010 and 2012, 2014, is that very few voters, maybe like zero or 10 in the whole country, have actually changed their party. What's happened basically is just Democrats stop voting, and so Republicans keep voting. So they win these elections with very low voter turnouts. And then back in the presidential years, when enough young people and poor people say, okay, I guess I need to vote, come out and vote, so the voter turnout rate gets up over 50%, then Democrats win. Now, Republicans can't win a national race at all if there's a voter turnout rate over 52 or 53%. They know that. They win on these off-year races when the percentage is down 33, 34, 35% nationally. And I think in some states it's as low as, 15, 20, 25%. So that's the scenario we're in. So I look at that as empowering. The people who benefit, like in Oregon with the GMO vote, the people who benefit by a low voter turnout, they understand they can't win a fair fight. They understand that if we had a level playing field, where we had actual journalism that covered politics, where we had choices for voters, where there was an engagement with citizens, and we drew people out to vote at the levels you find in democracies in South America and Europe, 65, 70, 85% of the population voting, that these, this would be a very different country, and they fear that, and I embrace that.
And so, what you're describing also creates a situation where, you have a Democratic president, and then the legislature stands opposed. And so it basically is a prescription for a stalemate on a lot of fronts. We just had a very close vote. One vote made the difference in turning down the Keystone XL pipeline. Of course, if it's revisited after the elections, that'll be different. Then you'll have a presidential veto. So we're, what do you predict for, this kind of stalemate we're heading into? And, I don't know that our presidential Democratic options are steadily improving either in terms of the upcoming election. What do you see devolving out of this? And then we can also talk a little, more about like what we can do to fix the situation, if anything.
Well, you're right. And I think that's really the dominant theme in the news media coverage is that we're in the midst of the stalemate, that stuff can't get done on Capitol Hill. And I think there we're penalized by the really pathetic nature of what passes for political journalism in America. The journalists can't tell the truth, because if they tell the truth, they're accused of being unprofessional and of being unobjective and biased. And the truth, of course, about this whole stalemate thing is it's entirely driven by the Republican Party that basically is playing, if we don't get our way, we're going to blow up the building. And, it's entirely their strategy and has been going back 20 years now. And it's not like the two sides can't cooperate. One side refuses to cooperate, period, and negotiate. So, and that's not, and I don't say that as a Democrat. I'm not a Democrat. I'm just saying that's an obvious state of affairs. When the roles are reversed and the Republicans have the White House, Democrats had control of the Congress. They weren't blowing up the building because they didn't get their way. Heck, they continued to vote for all the war policies during that period. And that leads to the second point, which is despite the sort of inane stalemate on issue after issue and pettiness that is really at times absurd, not approving the standard candidates for executive office, for example, which is traditionally something that's not debated or fought over, except in rare cases. But it also overlooks the fact that on crucial issues, there isn't that wide of a gulf between the Democrats and the Republicans. When it comes to spying on the American people, there are some nice backbenchers like Leahy and the Democratic Party and a few others. But the White House is totally on board with that. They're far more draconian, in fact, in their treatment of whistleblowers than the George W. Bush administration was. So there's pretty much an agreement of mind. When it comes to bailing out banks, there's pretty much an agreement of mind. When it comes to not prosecuting corporate felons, pretty much an agreement of mind. Right now, for example, the Obama administration is seeking out areas working with the Republicans, and the crucial one they're in love with is something called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I suspect your listeners are familiar with, which is basically a gift to the billionaires and corporations of the world to reduce any consumer, labor, or environmental or public health regulations that might interfere with the pursuit of profits across the planet. And this is completely bipartisan. There's no major political figure in the United States in the Republican or Democratic Party who opposes Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, even though the American people on all these trade deals going back now a quarter century invariably don't like them. They understand they're really fishy. And they're right. Since the early 90s, the people in power in this country, both Republican and Democrat, have done everything in their power to remove any discussion of trade deals from Congress and from the news media, so the American people won't get their way. They want to prevent democracy from taking place because they know this gift to the owners of the country can't go through if the American people have a say.
Yes, and there's some. I actually did a month of programming on these trade deals back in May, June. If any listeners want to go back and listen to that, it's all pretty much current today, and we're waiting to, you know, hear that there's going to be some. It seems like there is going to be another attempt after Fast Track was defeated, which is basically the way they rush it through to a vote in the legislature. Without discussing it or making public the actual provisions under discussion. I mean, you know, it's like blinded, no airing of what's actually in the treaties and the regulations, and no discussion or public input or interaction around that, no reporting on it. And that's what fast-tracking essentially does. And so they tried it, it was defeated, and now they're going to try it again. They just want to kind of, I've never even heard of something where, you know, a complex international treaty, and part of the real problem, as I see it, with these treaties is they create a kind of uber government. So right now we have, you know, corporations and various contributors contributing blindly without our knowledge into the electoral process and system. But this would actually give them authority over national, local, and state government and provisions and stuff like that. And if it violated a corporate agenda or lost the money for one reason or another, then, you know, your state government or you yourself would have to pay. I mean, you know, and yet this is what they're trying to to kind of rush through without anyone kind of knowing it. It's you know, in the old days we would call this pulling a fast one.
Well, Allison, if I can interject something, put this maybe even starker context.
Mm-hmm.
In our Constitution, it states that any treaty signed by the United States government trumps any law passed inside the country. It basically becomes part of the Constitution. It overrides any possible government action by the legislature in the state or local or federal level in the United States. So when you sign a treaty, you're in effect adding to your Constitution. It has that power legally. So imagine if someone tried to pass a constitutional amendment and only 200 people in the world would love to know what the content of it was before it got voted on. And there was no debate over it. We consider that, you know, that's when you have revolutions against that sort of tyranny. And that's exactly what's going on here. This is adding extraordinary provisions to our Constitution. It's like adding 50 amendments to the Constitution with absolutely no public participation, ran through without any consideration.
Yep. Thank you for that clarification because, you know, here we are. I mean, Let's flip the coin on that, or the pancake on that one, because, you know, Lawrence Lessig and others have called for, you know, an amendment to repeal, in effect, Citizens United, which allows this free flow of money into our electoral process. And, you know, that's been a struggle. You know, I'd love to hear your comments on that. How do we do what seems to be the sine qua non for a lot of this, which is getting money out of politics in the current climate? Is there a way to do that?
Well, yeah, you know, working through a system to change a system is always very difficult, but it can be done. Remember, for example, that women got the right to vote, and the constitutional amendment was passed, but through that onerous step guaranteeing women the right to vote, and all the people who voted on it to make it possible were men. They had to convince, you know, three-quarters of the men of the country to give women the vote. And it was done. It took a long time. It was a struggle. But it's not impossible to work through the system to change the system. And, you know, in the end, at the end of dollarocracy, one of the things that John and I emphasize is the importance of structural change, meaning a change in the Constitution. Take the money out of politics. Corporations aren't people. And also, most importantly, guaranteeing the right to vote, which we currently don't have in our Constitution. We're one of the few democracies in the world that doesn't guarantee the right to vote. In fact, when we, occupied Germany and Japan following the Second World War, when we go in and overthrow a country like Saddam Hussein in Iraq and write new constitutions in those countries or help write them, we guarantee the right to vote. We understand how important it is. Well, we don't have it ourselves. We need to have it. Because what's going on in this country where we're seeing poor people, people of color, young people being intentionally marginalized and made very difficult to vote, and there's no legal defense for them that's effective, means that's got to change. So John and I argued for that at the end of Dollarocracy. At the time, it was, I wouldn't say hypothetical, but campaigns for constitutional amendments seemed really like one in a million shot. I mean, that's like, who's kidding who on a constitutional amendment? You couldn't even get the Equal Rights Amendment passed in the 70s and early 80s when you have the majority of the country behind it and everyone's talking about how can you possibly get something that goes against the most interests of the most powerful people in the country, the richest people. And what has happened since then, just in the last 2 years since we wrote those words, is that there has been an explosion of activism trying to get constitutional amendments. It's even gone to the floor of the Senate. I think we have 42 senators in favor of this constitutional amendment now. So there is this grassroots activism going on. I think we're up in the high teens now, the number of states that have formally passed resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to take money out of politics and the corporations aren't people. So it's actually been, by historical standards, this spectacular success of grassroots organizing. There's no big money behind it. George Soros isn't paying for it. There's no liberal foundations. It's really people on their own just rising up. And because we don't have a news media left in this country that covers politics, we never had a great one, but now we have this don't even have one that's existing in many places. This doesn't get covered at all. No one even knows about it. It's just simply, so it's just only taking place purely word of mouth. It's like samizdat in the old Soviet Union when the official media didn't cover anything. And that's what's going on. So it's very exciting to see the way an enormous number of people have already said, look, this needs a radical change. We have to change the Constitution and have acted on it. I think that will eventually happen. I think that is going to be the solution. When it's going to happen, no one can predict. But that's the logical direction we have to go. And I think that, that's where a lot of the organizing attention has to go.
Let's take a break for station identification here on the Progressive Radio Network. That's a hopeful note, and we'll see that evolving over time, work for it, and help make it happen. We're talking today with Robert McChesney, the author, with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, and we'll be coming back for the second half of Connect the Dots after this break. Listeners, please stay with us for this conversation. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. If you're just joining the conversation, you're going to be able to hear and excited by the second half of the show. You'll be able to hear the first half of the show later in the Connect the Dots archives. Today we are talking with Robert W. McChesney, the author, with John Nichols of Dollarocracy. We're talking about how money and media election complex is destroying democracy in America. And for those who've been come back to join us for the second half of the show, thank you so much. Please do like us on iTunes and pass the program along to friends who may be interested. I would strongly encourage people to buy and read the book in its entirety, Dollarocracy. It's published by Nation Books. And in addition, you can find out more on the website for the book, which is Dollarocracy, that's spelled dollar, O-C-R-A-C-Y, hyphen, book.com. And so there's more about the book. You can order the book there. You can watch videos of Bob, our guest today, and John McNichols. They did some terrific online videos discussing all of the ideas in the book. This very prescient book, originally published in hardcover a year or so ago, now out in paperback and accessible for all to read. One of the things that I was at, let's talk a little bit about journalism and, what journalism looks like. As you may know, Bob, I was one of the very first journalists, one of two or three of us, who began covering the fracking issue back in 2008. I broke the story on Huffington Post and covered it there in an alternate for quite a number of years. And I was at an event recently where someone had written a book. The author shall be nameless. And the book is basically about how, you know, we're losing journalism and the threats to journalists and all of that. Their focus is entirely international. So in the discussion of the book, you know, basically they wanted to tell bad stories about foreign dictatorships who were bearing down on their journalists. And, you know, and it's a terrible thing, of course, and people's lives have been threatened or lost. You know, both foreign journalists and some Americans who travel into war zones and all of that. And so that was the whole discussion. But every time there was any question, I asked one, and there were about three or four other people in the audience who asked a question about American, you know, the sort of the threats or pressures on American journalists. Basically, the topic was like pass, you know, didn't want to discuss it. Later, I had a conversation after this book signing event with another journalist at a prominent, you know, international publication. And, you know, a couple of things. I mentioned your earlier book on journalism to him, and he'd never heard of it. So it was almost like, you know, it was almost a sense that this gentleman had written the first book on the subject, where, of course, you know, I was aware that the death and life of American journalism, and you've written quite a bit on this topic. They had never heard of that. You know, people there had never heard of it. And the guy also said to me, this international journalist, oh, I've covered fracking. And basically, you know, his publication sent him into the northwestern regions, you know, where there is a lot of fracking activity and where some of the early studies were done about the migration of fracking fluids into water supplies. And, you know, he basically told me, well, I talked to an industry person, and they assured me that if only the pipes, you know, could be made safe, there would be no leaching of toxic chemicals from them. So, you know, here you have a journalist. It's not his expertise. He kind of has a potpourri beat. He's not well informed on the issue. He's got a travel budget, something that I never had, you know, to go. And then he ends up, you know, through complete lack of familiarity with the topic, you know, basically towing the industry line. Because, you know, the fact is that between for the last, since 2009, when they basically exempted fracking from all of the major environmental regulations, knowing that there would be these problems, you know, Vice President Dick Cheney did this under the Bush administration. You know, if those cement pipes could so easily be made safe, which they can't, they fail, you know, they universally fail. You know, but yet they still keep offering this promise, oh, we'll make them safer. And you've got a so-called journalist, he was quite senior, you know, going out there on a budget and reporting, oh, well, they're just going to make them safer, you know, unaware of the fact they've been making that promise now for, you know, a number of years. So, you know, this to me in an area that I cover, you know, is shameful, shameful reporting, poor journalism. You know, and yet this is what is going on, and I think people have turned off to the media because they don't know what they're going to get there, really, except for, you know, a few programs, this one, Democracy Now!, you know, The Nation. I mean, there are outlets and everything, but I just, and then where you have, I mean, the gentleman who wrote the book about all of the international journalists are under threat was part of a media establishment that couldn't acknowledge that journalists here are having any economic, social, or political problems in doing their job. Would love to hear your comments on that.
Well, boy, there's a lot of great material in that statement you just gave. You know, let me put it generally in context. The United States once had a thriving commercial journalism for most of the 20th century, and it was supported by advertising, provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues, depending upon the news medium. And that journalism, by thriving, I mean there were lots of reporters, relatively speaking, in the country. At its peak in the 1970s and into the 80s, it had, you know, investigative reporters in many of our news media, science journalists, people covering This is the public health and science continuum. They actually knew something about science. They actually, there were foreign correspondents in most of the major cities of the world. And in Washington, D.C., you had 40 or 50 different newsrooms covering politics. So you had a lot of competition and diversity. Now, having said that, and a lot of my work has been about, even at its peak in the 70s and 80s, our mainstream journalism was still pretty deplorable on crucial issues. The sort of what's called professional journalism that emerged 100 years ago in the United States, the idea of neutral, nonpartisan, objective news, that sort of journalism worked okay for certain types of stories, but as a rule, it worked really poorly on stories where people in power agreed on something. When they weren't debating something, professional journalism didn't debate it either. It basically printed what they agreed on as if it was just not an undebatable given for a free society. So like American right to invade other countries has always been taken for a given in professional journalism, because both parties think they have the right to invade other countries when they're in power. Or the sort of corporate domination of our economy is taken as a given, because that's taken for granted by people in power in both political parties. So it had its weaknesses, great weaknesses, as well as certain strengths. But that's a distant history, a distant memory from where we are today. In the last 25 years, journalism, the resources related to journalism in the country have absolutely plummeted. And I think any of your listeners are well aware of this if they're over the age of, say, 35 or 40. Even younger, you would see the difference if you're 25 and paying attention. We have maybe about 35 to 40% of the number of working reporters and editors who are getting paid today in doing journalism as we had, say, the late 1980s. It's just fallen off the cliff. And what this means is that lots of stuff no longer gets covered. There's downward pressure on the wages and working conditions of those journalists to remain. And it's just been a nightmare for all sorts of stories. And it means that stories that would have gotten covered before don't get covered now, really important stories. Or instead of having 10 reporters or 5 reporters from different newsrooms covering a story, there's one reporter. If that reporter misses the story, it just doesn't get covered. No one else is there. The reason for this began by, I think, commercial pressure. All these monopolies and media mergers in the 70s, 80s, and 90s led to a situation where the owners could cut back on the number of reporters and still make even more money because it didn't affect their revenues. That was the first blade of the scissors. The other blade, though, is the Internet. And the Internet basically took us, taking away all the advertising money that made commercial journalism viable. And it's doing that because advertisers now can go online and they don't really buy an ad on a website and hope they get lucky and their target audience goes there. Instead, when they go advertise online, they basically go to one of the great ad networks like Google or Yahoo or Microsoft and say, hey, we want 2 million women who are between 35 and 44 who might buy an automobile in the next 4 months. And they will find those 2 million women immediately wherever they are online. They don't have to go to a news website. They don't have to go to any sort of contact website. They might find them at the Target website, for that matter. And because of this, the money that went to support journalism and pay for content creation no longer exists. And that's why, ironically, with all this hot air about new media, there's still more paid journalism by far in old media than there is in new media. That's the last vestige until the advertising dries up. And there's no future in store. So this is, in my view, and in the view of our book, Dollarocracy, and my other recent books, you know, this is an existential crisis for American democracy. Are we going to have an independent, competitive, well-paid, functional journalism that draws people into public life and informs them about issues and about what people in power are doing and people who want to be in power would do? And if we don't have that, our whole system doesn't work. It's really not a complex point. It's something that the framers of this country got. They were obsessed with it to the point where they instituted massive postal subsidies to create a free press that wouldn't exist without those massive postal subsidies. It basically distributed our newspapers virtually for free for a century to make it possible to be a newspaper publisher. But we have to face up to that crisis today in America. Despite the sort of homilies of this person who's concerned about journalism in other countries, it's an existential crisis right here and right now. Now, before we get, if you want, we can talk about solutions and stuff, but before we get to that, this ties into the point you were making about journalists being harassed, journalists not getting support. I think as we've seen the decline in the number of working journalists in the past 25 years or so, and a sharp decline in the last 5 to 10 years, journalists now are not taken seriously by people in power. They don't fear them as much. They know that, like the Obama administration knows, it can just put out its own propaganda on how it wants the world to be seen, and any politician can. And they have to less concern about interference from reporters, because there aren't that many of them, and they can be dismissed. And I think that makes it a lot easier then for the Obama administration, the Bush before it, and whoever the next president after, to go after journalists who are doing stories that they don't want done, investigative pieces, in a way that never would have been done in the past. The institution of journalism is just a much, much weaker footing than it's been in American history today. And this is the great, in our view, the great crisis behind oligarchy. We have great journalism. If we actually had independent newsrooms of people covering politics closely, you know, no one would give a darn about these stupid negative ads that flood the airways. They would have very little effect. But in an environment where there's absolutely no journalism except gossip, basically, on the networks from pundits about whose lies are working and whose aren't, without journalism, these TV ads are all that's there. So they do have an effect.
And yet, some of the independent media, I get a lot of emails, and I'm sure many of us do, Common Dreams, for example, begging for money, asking us to contribute, and yet, you do that, they do that, they have to do it. I understand why they're doing it. It's necessary to do it, and yet, the sense is that you've already destroyed your journalistic credibility by asking people to pay, nor do people have the expectation that they would or should be paying. It's all out there for free, albeit, with a lot of ads and a lot of your personal information, being circulated so they can sell stuff to you and all.
Allison, if I can interrupt you, it's not all out there. That's the problem. And I think you're right, though. There's the illusion that we're in the midst of an information blizzard, because you do a Google search and there are 7,800,000,000 responses to fracking. So you assume, God, the fracking must be covered up the yin-yang. There must be thousands of people doing nothing but investigating fracking. But that's not the case at all. The actual number of paid reporters earning a decent salary who are concentrating exclusively on the fracking issue, how many are there in this country? How many are there? I'm asking you, you would know better than I would, but I'm willing to bet you count them on one hand.
Yeah, I think, Think Progress and DSmog Blog, come to mind, but a lot of this is volunteer content.
I'm talking about people who actually, they have a credible journalism. You need people who can do it for a living. You need competition so someone misses it, someone else gets it. You need fact checkers. You need editors. It takes resources to do good journalism on a complex issue. It's not something you do. You put your kids to sleep, you get done with your job, you clean your house, you go shopping, then you sit down on your computer at 11:15 at night before you go to bed to get up at 6 a.m. and you write brilliant stuff on fracking. That's not how it gets done.
That's right. That's right. Well, I've lived that reality.
I know you do. And the crisis we face isn't that we don't have a lot of great people that could do wonderful journalism. It's that we have to face up to the fact the journalism, the commercial era is over. Now that advertising gave the illusion that we could have a fully functional news media supported by commercial interests seeking to maximize profits largely through selling advertising. But now that advertising has walked out the door and it's not coming back, it's got better options online, as a society, we're the framers of this country. We're the founders. What are we going to do to have a functional, independent, competitive news media that does the job necessary to have a functional democratic society? And it's going to require a public policy solution. I mean, I think this is, journalism is a classic public good. It's something society desperately needs, but that the market can't provide in sufficient quality or quantity. And it's going to need a political solution, or else we're not going to have them. We're living it right now. We're living the let's fantasize about new technology solving the problem for us moment, and it's crashing and burning before our eyes.
I agree with you completely, and yet that creates, this kind of conundrum, because we can't get any public policy solution happening. So, I completely agree with you, but for example, having read, you know, your books for, you know, and followed your work, and you know, I'll propose this to people, and they'll say, but we can't, you know, we can't get things through on a legal level, and then we're back to how where we began our conversation about that, which is, you know, what is the leverage point in this whole thing?
Well, I think actually where I would sort of disagree with you and the people you're talking to is about this.
Sure. But
the problem here is that I don't think anyone is acknowledging it. I think you. I think most of the listeners have not heard what I just said to them. They don't get that truth. So I think the people you talk to, oh, we can't talk about that because it's impossible. Well, they're not talking about it at all. I think if everyone just said, look, this is like public education. Either we're going to come up with a policy to create it and make it exist, or it won't happen and the society goes down the drain. That's got to be said. That's the truth. You don't hide the truth because, you know, Mitch McConnell won't pass a bill for you, so we can't tell the truth. When you pretend the Internet will solve the problem, like morons, you got to tell the truth. And no one's telling you. Start by telling the truth, and then let's see what happens.
All right. Well, I'm certainly game for that. You know, I mean, I think it would be fantastic, you know, for that to happen. You know, and it is a public good because we... But on a whole lot of levels, it's almost like the whole, you know, it's kind of like the things that are public goods are, you know, like journalism, like a, you know, a healthy environment, like public health, have all been demeaned in some kind of way. You know,
they have been, and that's the political moment we're in. You're right. I mean, that, it's been a very dangerous thing, and I think one way to look at all these processes, public education, public health, journalism, is that all the things that have been in the crosshairs of the Koch brothers and the corporate rights and the Tea Party, that they say these things are the evil things that have to go, are exactly those things we need. You know, the healthy democracy that gives, that actually has a chance to improve the quality of lives of people and give them the power to control their own lives. Those are the things you need to fight to get back. You know, just go down the checklist of the of Alec and the Koch brothers and see what they're going after. And those are pretty much the things they understand. They've got a pretty smart sense of how to undermine popular power and how to do that. And so we have to turn around and say, that's the thing, that's our checklist of what we've got to get strengthened.
Right. So in other words, and we have to create, what do you see as the biggest source of leverage for, you know, for turning things around in that way?
Well, I don't know if there's a simple answer to that question, but I mean, I'd start from this assessment, which is that this is not a right-wing country. We've got the numbers on our side. The people who are gutting newsrooms and don't want any policies to give us journalism, the people who are getting rid of environmental regulations, who are full speed ahead on fracking and oil drilling, the people who want to have maximum money in politics, the people who, you know, want to privatize public education, and go back to sort of a Charles Dickens era of class structure. That crowd understands their ideas can't win a majority of support in the country. That's why they are obsessed with making the political system as irrelevant and as fruitless as it currently is. They're getting voter turnout down into the 30s. And when we talk about a voter turnout at 35% of the population, or even at 55%, that doesn't do justice to just how corrupt and how unfair that is, because we're talking about a 35% of the population is disproportionately rich, disproportionately white, disproportionately old. It's old, white, and rich. And that's even true in presidential years. We don't have anything close to representative turnout. Voting in America today, even in presidential years, is entirely predicated on class. The 10% wealthiest Americans vote at a very high rate. The 10% poorest Americans barely vote at all, and there's a direct line from top to bottom for voter turnout. And it makes perfect sense. If you're poor, why vote? You're less to stick anyway. Now that if you do try to vote, you're going to get worked over by a right-wing goon squad. So, you know, who wants to do that? So, you know, the power comes from the fact that we've got the numbers on our side. We really do. I wouldn't have said that necessarily 35 years ago. I didn't have that confidence. Today I do. And then we know we have the numbers on our side because we see the effort the other side's going to prevent democracy.
Got it. That's brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Bob, for being with us today and sharing this view and your incredible analysis and also optimism about what we can do if we get together and we do it. Along the lines you're talking about, listeners, make sure to go out and get Dollarocracy in paperback, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, as well as the solutions that Bob and his co-author John Nichols offer. You can go to their website, go to Amazon, buy the book, read the book, get involved and participate. Thank you so much, Bob, for sharing this brilliant analysis with us today and talking here on Connect the Dots. Always a pleasure to have you here. Are you working on a new book?
I have a new book that's just coming out this week called Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, which is about a lot of these political issues in media. So I do have a new book, and I'll send you some, you know, maybe get a copy of it, maybe do a show on it.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to. We have to keep current with your evolving understanding. That'll be great.
Thank you,
listeners. Come back next week, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, every Wednesday on Connect the Dots on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.